This is Yaron Brook, guest speaking on Dr. Leonard Peikoff's podcast. I'm here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. Your real-life questions specifically to current events, including politics, economics, and foreign policy. My answers are posted every other week on Mondays. Leonard will continue to answer questions, but now only on alternate Mondays. You can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes at www.peikoff.com. If you have a question to ask me, simply go to peikoff.com/questions. So I get a lot of questions about Bitcoin. So let's put my views on Bitcoin on record and get it out there. And I'm sure there'll be follow-up questions, and I might or might not answer them depending on whether I think they're legit. So let me start by asking the question, this question. Would Bitcoin exist in a free market? And I think the answer to that is no. I do not think Bitcoin is a legitimate currency in a free market. In a free market, there would be competition. The market would ultimately determine whether Bitcoin was used or not. But I'm a strong believer that a currency, money in a free market, would be some kind of commodity, would be something real, would be something that had value beyond its use as a currency. The problem with Bitcoin as a currency is it has no value beyond its use as a currency, and therefore, why should it be used as a currency? Remember that money came into being as a medium of exchange, but as a medium of exchange, if you got stuck with it, it was useful in some way. You could do something with it. It wasn't just a perception today of money, of just a piece of paper. It was something that was useful in and of itself, like gold, like silver, which have functions beyond their function as money and are valued by human beings beyond just their function as money. Bitcoin has none of that. So Bitcoin is a code. It's a string of zeros and ones. So where does it get its value from? I don't think in a free market it would get any value. And I explain why I think it has value today and why it's being used today and what people what kind of value people today put on it. Something like Bitcoin could be used as a digital currency backed by some kind of commodity. So if it was exchanged to a commodity, so if it was just used as a convenience to do anonymous transactions or to do very quick transactions, all the benefits that Bitcoin would have for electronic transactions, it would be like using a credit card or using something else. But there would be a standard ultimately for exchange. It would all be exchangeable into this other value, this commodity, call it gold. And it would be issued by an entity, let me just finish the thought, that was willing to exchange it into that ultimate commodity. That contractually, if you will, was obligated. So in the zero ones, there would be a contract embedded, just like there's embedded in a paper currency in a free banking model, embedded the fact that contractually the bank is obligated to redeem it into gold. There would be a contractual obligation to have the Bitcoin redeemed into gold. If Bitcoin had that contractual obligation embedded in it, yeah, it would serve as a currency, but the money would be the gold. There is also the problem with Bitcoin of inflation, that is, of having a lot of it. Now, Bitcoin qua Bitcoin, people have argued you don't have that because there are only so many Bitcoins that will ever be issued. And those Bitcoins, the way it's being done is actually there'll be a cap on the number of Bitcoins. I can't remember. Some year in the future, they will stop production of Bitcoins. There'll actually be a finite number of Bitcoins in existence. But anybody can create Bitcoins. They might not be called Bitcoins. They might be coined Quitcoins or Bit something else. I don't know, whatever. And my understanding is there are already alternatives to Bitcoin. And you could create that ad infinitum, right? Because there's no limit to zeros and ones you can put together to create this. So you could have an infinite amount of digital currency. There's no limit to how much digital currency could be created. And why some would use Bitcoin and not this other coin or some other digital coin or whatever, I don't know. I mean, I don't see why Bitcoin has any unique features that cannot be replicated by others. And therefore, you would create massive inflation in the digital coin space. So it doesn't solve the inflation problem. Finally, why is it valued today and why are you people using it today? And I think that is because people are fearful of the dollar because they think it's going to become useless and they're looking for alternatives. So Bitcoin is a product of that fear. But more than that, I think we worry about our privacy today, and for good reason, given the NSA, given government intrusion in our life, given the role government takes in our economy and everywhere around us, people are looking for ways in which to remain private, in which to remain out of the government's ability to monitor their transactions, and Bitcoin provides that. So right now, Bitcoin is providing a value. The value is privacy. The value is that it's not the dollar, and people are embracing that value. But if you could, again, in a true laissez-faire capitalist economy with free banking, I do not believe Bitcoin would exist. Now, if you ask me how much is Bitcoin worth today, I have no idea. I think it's a function of fear and a function of how bad things become for the dollar and whether people continue to use Bitcoins. That is, how prevalent is its use and to what extent it's being used on the black market. I think that is what sustains Bitcoin. It's the fear of the government, it's the fear of the dollar, and it's the ability to use it anonymously. Here's another money-related question. What's the deal with QE? Where's all the money gone? Why is there no inflation? So I think there are a number of issues here. One, I mean, in a sense, there is inflation. In a sense that some places, prices have gone up dramatically. For example, the stock market. Housing prices are back up dramatically. So housing inflation, if you will, if you look at rents, if you look at home prices in California, at least, through the roof. My home has probably gone up in value 30 to 40% in the last 12 months. So you're not seeing inflation as a broad price rise. But remember, the government CPI, consumer price inflation, is a particular basket. Yes, that particular basket hasn't gone up much, but other baskets have gone up a lot. For example, as I said, rent, buying a home, stocks have gone up, certain investment categories have gone up. Land, I don't know if you've seen the price of land over the last 3, 4, 5 years. You know, it's gone up 4 or 5 times. Yeah, farmland in particular, farmland, not just general land, farmland, timberland. So we have seen the money go into rises in prices in many, many areas, not yet throughout the economy. Other phenomena that are probably going on, you are seeing some deflationary pressures in a sense of increased productivity that lowers the prices of goods. So that has the fact that prices are not gone down in certain areas might suggest that the money that's gone into the economy just holding them flat is inflation in the sense that in a normal time, the prices would have actually gone down. That is also possible. But I think what's also happening is, of course, less money has been created than we think because the banks are holding all the money in reserve. So while the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve has increased by, I don't know, $4 trillion, the banks are holding about $2 trillion in reserve at the banks, at the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve is paying interest on that money. So that money hasn't really gone into circulation. We haven't seen it multiplied. We haven't seen the velocity of money return to normal. And as long as the velocity of money doesn't return to normal, or as long as it's very, very low, you can print money and not have an impact on inflation. So I think it's all of those things combined that are having an impact. That there is inflation in some places, that there's increase in productivity, which should be driving prices down in other areas, and that not as much money as some people believe has been created has actually been created because it's sitting in the banking system not being used because the government doesn't want the banks to use it, because regulators won't let them use it, because people are not demanding loans as much as they would in a normal economy, and so on and so forth. So there's not as much supply of money as people would believe. Follow on to that question was, do I believe the structure of production is being altered and capital assets are being inflated? Do I think there are bubbles out there? Absolutely. Absolutely. Don't ask me where. Don't ask me what they are. Maybe farmland. Maybe bonds. You know, maybe home prices again. But is the structure of production, that is, are people making investments in production that if the government wasn't manipulating the money supply, wasn't manipulating interest rates as much as they are, would they be still making those investments? And my answer is Absolutely, there are huge distortions, massive distortions. You cannot artificially keep interest rates at 0% and not have distortions. You cannot increase, you know, buy bonds at the rate of $4 trillion or $85 billion a month and not create massive distortions. So investments are being distorted. When I taught finance, we used to teach that you make an investment based on its net present value. That is, whether it is profitable on a net present value basis. Are you going to make money when you look at over time and when you discount to present value terms all the cash flows from the future? And if the interest rate is completely distorted, that whole calculation is distorted. And if the interest rate is approaching zero, then long-term investments, you're over-investing in the long-term and under-investing in the short-term, which is probably what's happening now. Where's that manifest? How is that manifest? You know, I don't know enough about what's going on out there in the economic world, and it's very hard to assess that. All you can say is there are massive distortions and we will pay the price one day. Okay, another question economically, but this is outside of the U.S. What do I think of China? I got a number of questions about China. Will it continue to rise economically? And what do I think generally is going to happen in Asia more broadly? So, you know, China will continue to grow economically. I think it will grow in the foreseeable future. But China has some massive problems. It has a large government sector in China, government-controlled companies, government-owned companies that are huge losers, that are not productive, that are a drag on the Chinese economy. The banking system in China is horrifically manipulated, is a branch of the Chinese government, is involved in massive central planning and is very destructive and therefore is going to give the Chinese economy massive problems. China has inflated its economy artificially by boosting government spending. You've got massive amounts of real estate that was invested in that has no use, that it empty cities sitting around. So there's a lot of problems in the Chinese economy, a lot of problems. And there's a lot of social pressures in China because there's still hundreds of millions of people who are dirt poor in China who have not benefited from all the increase or not benefited as much from the increases, dramatic increases in wealth creation in China. And they want more economic growth so that their fate will increase. And yet it's not clear that China can grow fast enough to help them rise out of poverty. So there are going to be social pressures in China. And then there's also a population problem, a demographic problem in China. China will start aging soon. Because of its one-child policy, the Chinese population is going to start shrinking at some point. And that's not good economically. That means fewer people working, fewer people producing, fewer people making stuff, fewer people being innovators. So you've got a lot of problems. So I don't see China as this all rosy, going to grow forever economy. It's got major problems. It's going to have a major, what some economists call correction. It's going to have to have a major fixes, which means moving towards more freedom. And I'm not sure the Chinese government is ready for that. And I mean economic freedom. And I'm not sure the Chinese government is ready to do that. On the other hand, the Chinese are incredible, entrepreneurial. There's real wealth creation going on there. There's real production going on there. There's real wealth creation. So there's some in the areas and where the Chinese government has left Chinese businessmen alone, has left areas in China free of government regulations and government control and central planning, Chinese industry and Chinese wealth creation has thrived. And that's the battle between those free elements in the economy and those statist elements in the economy. And hopefully China will be able to free up the statist elements in the economy at a regular pace so that it avoids the catastrophe. The rest of Asia is very tricky. You know, I'm generally positive on some places like Singapore, Hong Kong, you know, South Korea, Taiwan, and so on, that have moved dramatically towards more free economies. I worry about Japan, who have a horrific demographic problem. They're the fastest shrinking population in the world, aging population, fewer and fewer people working, producing, creating, destructive economic policies. Japan is in big trouble. It's got a high standard of living. Whether it can sustain that high standard of living is really questionable. So generally, Asia's in better condition than the West, because it's moving towards freedom as the West is moving away from freedom, with exception of Japan, which I think is moving away from economic freedom. And therefore, Asia will do better over the next few decades than the West is, although if China has a massive economic crisis, which it could, the rest of Asia will suffer with it.
If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peakoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most important novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And I might add that it wouldn't hurt you to read my latest book, The Dim Hypothesis.